All right, hello UN Plaza people. This is a special edition of UN Plaza today. I am reporting from the United Nations building. For once, I am at the United Nations building and not my regular interlocutor. Today is a, as I said, a special edition of Blogging Heads of UN Plaza. Instead of one single solitary interviewee, I have interviewed a half dozen or so folks, ambassadors, UN staffers, people up to cool things here at the UN. This has been organized today. As you can see from the background, I'm not alone. There are about a dozen talk radio hosts, as you can see behind me, who are participating in something called Talk Radio Day at the UN, which is sponsored by the United Nations Foundation, and regular viewers know that the UN Foundation also sponsors UN Dispatch. I would like, in particular, to thank one person for helping me out today. His name is Matthew Cordell. Say hello, Matthew. Matt has been helping a lot with the technical aspects of organizing, setting up all of these interviews today. So with that, we'll get started and enjoy. I am joined now by Ambassador Haroon of the Pakistani Mission to the United Nations. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you first about the big news of the day, which is President Obama's speech in Cairo. I wanted to know if his speech matched your expectations and your general reaction to his talk today.
I believe too much is being asked from him in the speech. There were very high expectations, which is unfair to begin with. But what I would say is he has created some hope. There are some new things he said. There are some paradigm shifts as being seen by envoys of the UN from around the world. But I think the relevant portion is, as far as we're concerned, there was no mention of terrorism in his speech, which left us a little short-winded. You know, I thought, my God, is that an omission that is deliberate or not?
And what is your take? Was it deliberate, do you think?
I can't say. Mm-hmm. I'm not in the business of guessing.
Okay.
But I think it was important it should have been said, and it was not said.
Okay. I guess, you know, another bit of news today, speaking of terrorism, was the release of Hafiz Saeed from house arrest in Pakistan. I'm wondering, for viewers unaware, he's leader of the LET, which is an organization that the Security Council designated as being affiliated with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. I'm wondering if you have any reaction to news today about that.
Well, let me correct you.
Please.
He was not the leader of the LET.
Okay.
That's another person. As far as Hafiz Saeed is concerned, the Security Council Taliban committee created a prescription. His entire affairs, his organization, his money, his travel, everything proscribed. But there was no suggestion for him to be incarcerated. And you must remember that through a people's struggle in Pakistan, the courts have been reinvigorated by the return of judges who are fiercely independent. And when there was no requirement of incarceration in the United Nations order, and within the laws of that order, they asked the government to explain why he was arrested and why he should not be released. And I don't think that they could do very much more than show the order. On the basis of that, I think he was released by a fairly clear decision of the court.
As a diplomat, are you worried at all about the effect this might have with Pakistan's relationship with India? And are you worried about how India might perceive this decision?
I would put it two ways, and I have said this much myself. Are you familiar in any way with the work of Hafiz Saeed? He's not LET, he's Jamaat-e-Dawah.
Okay.
And it's a purely social organization.
Mm-hmm.
Who works not for Islam alone, but as charitable work around the world.
Mm-hmm.
When the tsunami hit Sri Lanka, they were the strongest presence on some parts of the coast. And they have letters from the ICRC to prove that. When the earthquake hit in Iran, they were the first to get there and again have relevant documents available showing the work they did there. And when, of course, the earthquake hit Pakistan, they were amongst the first. They run a very large myriad of institutions which in fact contribute to social good. Now, if you say that, but they have an ideological belief, or maybe they do, well, that's not enough to sink anyone. Otherwise, you'll have every second group in the US of A being accused of something or the other on based on the ideology. So it's not that. I think one must be rational towards it. The United Nations did not order his incarceration. And the Supreme Court released him on the belief that it was outside the parameters of the prescription.
Are you worried that this might complicate your relationship with India at all?
Well, you know, India is a fairly large and mature country. I think we have had reasons to believe that at times both India and Pakistan have behaved in a fashion which one might not consider to be very appropriate. But let me tell you this, and I have no doubt in my mind that this has to change. India is assuming larger proportions. I think we're not into elections anymore. The situation is not what it was a few months ago. The reality of this is that, yes, they have made a noise about it, but I don't think that noise is going to be as effective as it was a couple of months back when they were in elections. And the very interesting thing about the Indian voter, the BJP tried to play up the anti-Pakistan card, and they lost elections badly. And Narendra Modi, who was responsible for the deaths of a number of Muslims in India, who thought he was going to sweep his state, lost half the seats and didn't get the results he anticipated. I think the Indian people, the Indian government, and the Indian nation by large are not... I think they would like to see security. They would like to see much more openness on the borders. They'd like to see an intermingling of the races. And I think to exaggerate that into any other direction...
Switching topics, I was wondering if you could describe the humanitarian situation right now in the Swat Valley. You know, there have been a flood of refugees. Is Pakistan getting what it needs from the international community to meet this crisis?
We had close to 3 million refugees from the Afghan war spillover. It's still there. We still have a large number of people from the earthquake 2 years ago. We had floods last year. We had a large number of people displaced since then, and now this. I don't think we can really afford it. Our resources are strained to the absolute limit. We were preparing for this for a long time. We anticipated this. We said to them, we'd cover it as much as we could. The United Nations will tell you 80% of those affected by SWAP, and the diaspora is over 2 million, are already living with people who have homes who can help them. For example, in my home in the north of the country, we are helping people living there. And we're feeding them as well and doing what we can. So if 80% of their diaspora are being looked after by Pakistanis who are sharing their scant resources, it's 20% which number about 500,000 plus, which I believe are the difficult situation. Now, Ban Ki-moon spoke on this 2 days ago. He said, we didn't get any money. We're anticipating money. And I think he's today in Washington trying to raise some. He's meeting the vice president and many others. I believe that the response so far has been inadequate. Now, whether you respond or not, we'll go to it alone. We'll put our situation right for what it's worth. But I think at a time like this, when the Al-Qaeda and Taliban are threatening world security, the world has a responsibility to fight it here. Because if they don't fight it here, they'll have to fight it in other places. It might be China, it might be India, it might be the Middle East. So they will get to the strategic assets of the world and threaten from there, or maybe the United States again. So it would be appropriate thinking to stop them getting their drugs.
So along those lines, since taking office, as you well know, the Obama administration has combined, in a way, the conflict in Afghanistan and expanded it into Pakistan and combined strategies. And this has included an increased use of airstrikes, of unmanned drones on Pakistani territory.
I don't think unmanned drones have helped anything.
Mm-hmm.
They may have got the vagrant Al-Qaeda man,
mm-hmm.
but the political fallout is immense. And I don't think... I wish they'd give us the drones and let us handle it directly ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It would have a better impact. Now, I tell you, I think there is a substantial acceleration of making it understood, even here, that the Pakistani people need our help.
Mm-hmm.
But between words, and we're very grateful for the administration's policy and all that it's doing, but between those words and actual implementations, we're still a little far away. And in fact, you might be interested to know that a poor country like Pakistan was recently hauled up by the IMF, saying, you're deficit financing again. And we looked at those figures, and it was found out that the oil supplies to Afghanistan, to the American forces there, the bill for about $900 million to $1 billion hasn't been paid by the US of A on actual supply. So I think, let alone what we need, and we need communication equipment, night goggles, we need better ordnance, and we need a lot of things that will help this effort. I think we are even helping deficit finance your requirements in Afghanistan to a degree that we cannot afford. I'm sure the bills will be paid, and for it not to be paid for a year has put us in a quandary. So really speaking, we're doing everything. We're fighting this war. You might believe it's for the world. I believe it's for ourselves. And the only thing is, any aspect from here will flow to the rest of the world. So it's best we put our shoulders together, our heads together, our resources together, and do something about it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Ambassador. I am now joined by Ambassador Sawyer of the United Kingdom. Welcome, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you very much.
And we have a limited amount of time. I wanted to talk a little bit about the situation of Sri Lanka. Last week, the Human Rights Council failed to vote affirmatively to in any way issue an investigation into the crisis stemming from the endgame of the civil war there. I'm wondering, and it also seems that the Security Council process is somewhat stalled to Sri Lanka. I'm wondering if that is an accurate representation of the current state of play at the Security Council.
Well, I think that's not a full representation.
Okay.
The Security Council has been involved on the issue of Sri Lanka now over the last 2 months. And I think the pressures that we brought to bear, the role of the Secretary General, of his senior staff like Mr. Nambiar, his chief of staff, and John Holmes, the humanitarian coordinator, who have been to Sri Lanka several times and kept a spotlight on the behaviour of the Sri Lankan armed forces. I think that has been an important influence in this situation. Now, let's be absolutely clear about one thing. The Tamil Tigers are a terrorist organisation. We've got no sympathy with the Tamil Tigers whatsoever, and they are the ones who were primarily abusing international humanitarian law by using civilians as human shields, by pursuing a terrorist campaign, and by not pursuing their grievances through political means. Now, we believe that the Sri Lankan government could have taken more care about avoiding civilian casualties, could have been much more respectful of their own commitments about using heavy weapons and so on. But the conflict has now come to an end. What's important now is two things. First of all, that the hundreds of thousands of civilians who fled the fighting are able to receive humanitarian relief until such time as they can go home. And the second thing is that the Sri Lankan government initiates and leads a political process that addresses the legitimate political grievances of the various minorities.
It seems, though, that the Sri Lankan government has been reluctant, for example, to open up the IDP camps that are currently being administered by the military to groups like the ICRC and to foreign media in particular.
Yeah.
What can be done by the Security Council or by your government to apply pressure on the government of Colombo to allow greater access to these camps?
Well, we've been pressing this for some time. I think the access to the camps for those displaced by the fighting has improved, at least the access for the ICRC and for the UN agencies. Access for the media is still very poor, and we think it's actually in the Sri Lankan government's own interests that the international media can observe and report accurately on what is happening, especially now the fighting's over. So we'll keep up the pressure on that, but I do think the single most important issue is this political process that we look to the Sri Lankan government to initiate and to lead in order to find a new political dispensation, which gives no basis for extremists in the Tamil community or any other communities to pursue their concerns by fighting.
I guess finally, would you, as part of the political process, would you support some sort of accountability mechanism for those Sri Lankan military leaders as well as Tamil Tiger militants to face some sort of justice and some sort of judicial recourse to what apparently are been terrible human rights atrocities committed?
Well, we certainly think a proper investigation into the events in the Vani area where the Tamil Tigers had their last stand, I think would be important. It seems that most of the Tamil Tiger leaders themselves were killed in that final conflict. The Sri Lankan government did agree to the Secretary General's demand during his recent visit that there should be a proper investigation and accountability for on the Sri Lankan side. Now, in international law, this is primarily a responsibility for the government concerned. The Sri Lankan government have given an undertaking that they will do this, and we look to them to fulfill that undertaking.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for
your time.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks. Welcome back. I'm joined now by Henri Paul Normandin, the deputy firm rep from Canada. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, I should say I have Canadian roots myself. My parents are both born and raised in Montreal. My family is Canadian, although I am from here in the United States.
Well, pleased to meet you. We'll make you an honorary Canadian.
Exactly. And we'll get to predictions in tonight's Stanley Cup playoff game later on, of course.
Yes.
But first things first, on a more serious note, I'm always been curious to know how a country like Canada, that is not a permanent member of the Security Council, but is nonetheless economically powerful and in other respects a well-respected country around the world, how it is able to pursue its interests at the UN and what it defines as its interests at the UN.
Well, Canada obviously has a very broad agenda at the UN, from peace and security to human rights to development. In terms of peace and security, for instance, whenever the Security Council deals with issues, we always try to find a way to provide our input into the discussions. A case in point would be Afghanistan. As you may know, we're heavily invested in Afghanistan, Canada that is. We have many troops out there, we contribute to development and so on. And of course, every now and then, the Security Council looks at the issue of Afghanistan and provides the mandate for the UN mission there, UNAMA. And whenever there are negotiations on the resolution that deals with UNAMA to provide direction to the work of the United Nations, we're there. We work with the members of the Council, we get our voice heard, and also at times we speak directly at the Council. So that's one example. Another example is in the domain of peacekeeping. You know, Canada has always been heavily invested in peacekeeping. We still have a number of troops and policemen that contribute to peacekeeping missions. So we do this on a regular basis. And at the UN in New York, for instance, I chair the Special Committee on Peacekeeping Operations. And in this sense, I try to get the countries to work together to develop the right kind of guidelines for the UN, the UN's interventions in various countries. So these are but two examples of the type of work that we do here at the UN on peace and security. I would add maybe one last one. We've contributed over the years to the expansion of the work of the UN in fields that were not familiar before. One example is protection of civilians. 10 years ago, the UN did not really get involved into protection of civilians, but it does so more and more. The last time we were on the Security Council, we contributed to expanding the work of the Security Council in this area, these areas, and that continues today.
Is that specifically, or are you referring to the responsibility to protect, which in many ways is something of a Canadian initiative?
Yes, in part, responsibility to protect is definitely part of the agenda, and Canada made a significant contribution to get this norm entrenched at the United Nations. But protection of civilians goes somewhat beyond that. For instance, in peacekeeping missions, it used to be that peacekeepers would only look after rebels and government armed factions, and they would not really care about civilians around. Well, now they do, and it's in part because of the work that Canada did. In terms of women, peace, and security, you know, in conflicts, women are often left aside. They're only seen as victims, but not as participants to the solution. It's one thing that we have advocated very strongly to involve women in peace processes. There have been some progress. There has been some progress on that front, but we would like to see more.
And how long have you been working at the UN?
This is my third year.
Your third year. So you've experienced two American administrations.
Yes.
How would you characterize any change in Canada's relationships with U.S. or the U.S. at the UN in general?
Well, regardless of the administration, Canada has always worked very closely with the U.S. at the United Nations. We don't always share the same views, but in broad terms, we have a similar agenda in terms of promoting peace, in terms of promoting respect for human rights, and so on. And there are several instances where we directly work together, again, regardless of the administration. One such area, for example, is, in conflicts, there is a lot of violence against women. And last year, both Canada and the U.S. worked together to elaborate new approaches by the United Nations to address this issue. And, of course, the United States being on the Council, the Security Council, the United States managed to get a resolution through, but with a lot of groundwork done by Canada and others. That's, again, one of several examples, but in general, we work very closely at the UN. Our cooperation, specifically in Afghanistan, is a very good example of that. Our cooperation together as well in Haiti is another example, and both on the peace and security front and on the development front, and again, of course, on human rights. And since you often refer to the Security Council, allow me to mention
that
Canada is on the Security Council about every 10 years.
Yes.
And actually, we're currently a candidate for a tenure in 2011 and 12.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
is Canada's frequent rotation a consequence of its... are you part of the WEOG group?
Yes, we are part of the WEOG group, yes.
Okay.
But it will be a competitive election.
It will be, okay.
Yes.
Okay, well, we're pulling for you.
Thank you.
A question on Haiti. Early in the Haiti intervention, the RCMP, and then there was a lot of Canadian military, Canadian police, and Canadian contributions. Are there still, to my knowledge, the majority of peacekeepers in Haiti right now are Brazilian and Jordanian? Is there does Canada feel that perhaps it's overextended itself militarily with commitments to, say, Afghanistan, that it's less willing now than it has historically to contribute peacekeepers?
Yes. In the case of Haiti, we've been present in Haiti for a long time, and we've had troops for a long time. You're accurate in saying that at this point in time, our main presence in the United Nations force in Haiti is essentially with policemen. We have about 100 policemen and policewomen in Haiti. That's one. We do have a number of officers as well elsewhere in the mission. And of course, in Haiti, we have a huge development assistance program. So we're heavily invested in making a significant contribution alongside with the U.S. and Brazil and others. In terms of Canadian soldiers or troops on the ground, at this point in time, we indeed have a very heavy investment in Afghanistan, and that is the immediate focus. But it's not because we're heavily invested in Afghanistan that we're not present elsewhere in various ways. And Haiti is an excellent example of that. We may not have soldiers, but we have many policemen, and we have a very strong development program because, in the case of Haiti, Haiti needs security, but it also needs development in order to move forward, and we're contributing to both fronts.
And along those lines, were you surprised to learn of President Clinton's appointment as Secretary General Special Envoy to Haiti?
President Clinton has always had a deep interest in Haiti, and I think that his appointment will actually be very useful in bringing about more profile to the situation in Haiti, because there are still many challenges. Haiti at this point in time is not in a deep crisis. It has made some progress, but we need to sustain the attention and the involvement in Haiti, and I think that that's what Canada is trying to do, that's what the U.S. is trying to do, and the appointment of former President Clinton, I think, will contribute to maintaining our focus in Haiti.
So you think it'll help raise the profile of the situation in Haiti?
Yes, indeed, and I think that the government of Haiti very much wants that, you know, because one thing that is striking at the United Nations, when there are crises in whichever country, this becomes the topic of the day here at the UN, and that's what makes the headlines, you know, in the papers. But when a conflict when a country gets stabilized, suddenly it tends to get a little bit off the radar screen. Yet, after a conflict, we need to continue to be involved in that country in order to ensure that peace is built on solid foundations, and we have to work on development. And that's a bit of a challenge that the UN and the international community has had in the past, to maintain engage in a country, even after a conflict. So that's what we're currently trying to do in Haiti, and I think that the appointment of President Clinton will contribute to help the UN and help us maintain our focus.
So along to less serious or perhaps more serious matters. tonight, Game 5, the Stanley Cup, Game 6, pardon me,
yes,
of the Stanley Cup Finals between Pittsburgh and Detroit. Any predictions?
Well, I think it's going to be a turning point, because I think that if Pittsburgh loses this one at 3-1, it'll be very difficult for Pittsburgh. However, if they make it tonight and make this 2-2, I think anything is possible. Mm-hmm. For sure, we've had some very good games since the beginning, and I personally look forward to watching the game tonight.
Mm-hmm. And I look forward to a Habs victory in 2010 and 2011.
Thank you so much. We're really looking forward to that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Both regular blogging heads, UN Plaza viewers, will recognize this face. This is Anita Sharma. Anita, remind us, refresh us, what is your affiliation? What do you do?
I'm the North American coordinator for the United Nations Millennium Campaign, and the Millennium Campaign works in support of the Millennium Development Goals, which is the historic opportunity to end extreme poverty and hunger. And in addition to that, the goals really work to empower women and to improve access to health care, protect the environment, getting people clean water, and all by 2015. So we've got some tremendous challenges ahead, but we really think that with everybody pulling together, the goals are still achievable.
So last time we talked was in April, right around the time of the G20 summit in London. And that summit was billed as a historic opportunity, not only to offer some sort of corrective or global cooperation to respond to the financial crisis, but also by folks in the advocacy community as an opportunity to do something about global poverty. I was wondering if you can refresh us as to what happened at that meeting, and then maybe we can talk a little bit later about sort of if what has agreed upon has been followed up.
Well, at the April summit, there was this real notion that business as usual just could not continue. So we had this crisis in capitalism, hedge funds out of control. What had happened in the U.S. mortgage industry was just reverberating around the world. And unfortunately, it is the poorest and most vulnerable who feel the effects of the financial crisis, even though they had done little or nothing to cause the crisis. And so at the summit in London, where all of the G20 leaders came together, there were some pledges that were made. Something like $500 billion was pledged for the IMF, which is the International Monetary Fund, to help those countries deal with the effects of the crisis. Because what had happened was governments were not able to provide assistance to their people because their remittances were drying up, money wasn't flowing back to them, foreign direct investment was leaving. You know, people were losing their jobs because of demand, but lack of demand for U.S. products. And so it was just a real kind of downward cycle. And so the G20 summit was an effort to address that. And so at the final communique, you know, they made this effort to say that we will increase assistance to the IMF. We will work to ensure that there's greater financial accountability. We'll work, the leaders would work to close some of the tax havens. And now, so, you know, all of those promises were made in April. Now, since that time, it's even been questionable how much of that money is actually recycled commitments, what's true. In the U.S., the U.S. has pledged to give about $100 billion to the IMF. A lot of that is through gold sales. And even though people were skeptical that that was going to happen, just recently the Senate passed a bill, and it was tied to a couple of other things, but for about $108 billion. And the House is expected to follow suit. So that's fantastic. The question, though, is how much of that money is actually being dispersed to the countries that need it the most, and versus going to some of the middle-income countries. So it's something that we're continuing to monitor. But it's the challenge when leaders get together and they make promises and they make commitments. Unless people like us hold them accountable, it's really easy just to recycle the same old and do business as usual and go home and clap yourselves on the back and nothing happens.
So this week, or I should say late last week, it was announced that Pittsburgh, PA, is going to be the site of the next G20 meeting, and there's actually going to be a flurry of activity in September when that G20 is scheduled. Why don't you give us sort of a lay of the land of what to expect?
Some upcoming events.
Yeah, of upcoming sort of big events in sort of the global poverty and in global finance world.
One of the topics at the G20 was a real need to create a global and green economy so that when new jobs are being created, they're green and they're working for the environment as opposed to creating to climate change. And climate change is another issue which really impacts the poorest and most vulnerable, and these are people who are not the major emitters. So coming up in September 22nd at the United Nations, there's going to be a high-level event on climate change. And that is going to work to build momentum toward the final summit in Copenhagen in December, which is when all of the major emitters in the world, especially the United States and China and India, need to come together and develop some really hard targets to reduce emissions from carbon dioxide. And so that meeting is going to be here at the UN. Then the following day, on September 23rd, is the UN General Assembly. And this will be President Obama's first time on the UN stage, and so everybody, I think, is going to want to have the opportunity to shake President Obama's hand and to see him here at the UN. Partly because of that, the United States had offered to host the next G20 summit, and they've chosen
Pittsburgh. Everyone's going to be here.
So they've chosen Pittsburgh. But what that means is, so the Pittsburgh summit is going to be the 24th to the 26th of September.
Yeah.
So everybody from the G20, including the UN Secretary General, will leave the UN and go en masse to Pittsburgh to have the next session.
So this has been a very good year for Pittsburgh. They won the Super Bowl. Last night, the Pittsburgh Penguins won their first game of the Stanley Cup Finals.
It's a big deal.
Netroots Nation will be there. Is happening in August.
Yep.
And there's it's a good year. So what can we expect?
It is a big year for Pittsburgh. And I know that when Robert Gibbs, who's the press secretary at the White House, announced it, I think there were some snickers from the press corps.
Yeah.
And since then, the mayor, Luke Ravenstahl, has done a lot to explain how Pittsburgh is on its way back up. It's been, obviously affected by the economic crisis itself for many years. But they're hosting at the Pittsburgh Convention Center. It's a LEED certified, very environmentally friendly building. So they're really happy to be hosting. And I think one of the things that we're all going to need to do is really take a look and see, okay, well, what's happened since the April meeting and all of those promises that were made? Where are countries? And again, on the momentum toward the final meeting before Copenhagen, what is going to happen at this meeting? So there's a lot of momentum building. And I think for all of us, all of us campaigners, people in civil society, faith-based organizations, and student groups, we can learn what we are hoping to get out of this meeting. And the fact that it's going to be the United States and this is going to be President Obama's stage, I think we have a lot of potential here for impact.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. And, we'll again check back with you after the Pittsburgh Summit.
And I just have to make one plug.
Yes.
In addition to all this, the flurry of different activities here at the UN, the Millennium Campaign does a yearly mobilization called Stand Up and Take Action Against Poverty, and this year it takes place on October 16th through the 18th. It starts on World Food Day and ends on the International Day to Eradicate Poverty, and we're hoping to get as many people as possible throughout the world to stand up and take action. Last year we had 117 million people. That's 2% of the world's population. This year we're really hoping to double those figures, and ideally if President Obama were to stand with us, that would just be fantastic. So if
let's
you want to get
happen.
Let's make it happen. All if right. you want to get more information about it, go to endpoverty2015.org.
Yeah. Welcome back. I am now joined by what amounts to a Blogging Heads regular, Nick Birnbeck from the UN Department of Peacekeeping Operations. Welcome, Nick. So, Nick, what's your official title, just so I get that straight?
I am the chief of the Peacekeeping Public Affairs Section.
Excellent. Okay. So we probably talked maybe close to a year ago, I'd say, about various issues facing UN peacekeeping, about the fact that it's sort of overstressed and there's a lot on its plate. I was hoping today we can talk a little bit about a few of the more high-profile missions that we have. Last time I checked, the United Nations African Union mission to Darfur was not deployed to its full mandate. I'm wondering if you can give us an update on sort of the extent to which UNAMID, as it's called, is deployed and what some of the holdups are.
Okay, well, that we're still not fully deployed. We've got about 70% of our total authorized strength there, a little bit less, around 16,400 total personnel on the ground. We'll have over 90%, around 92, I think, by the end of the year. So we're getting there. It's slow. Deploying to Darfur is deploying to one of the most inhospitable places in the world. It's very far away from a fort. The airfields are such that it's difficult to move equipment and material in there, and you've hit the rains. So there's a lot of working against us, but we're getting there slowly. And again, by the end of the year, we should have over 90%, around 92%.
And what countries make up the bulk of the forces that have been already deployed?
Well, the forces for UNAMID are primarily from Africa, because the Sudanese government was very insistent on this point in the agreement that the predominantly African character of the force would be maintained. So we have Nigerians, and we've got Rwandans and others that are there. But we also have forces from a variety of other outlets, including the Chinese and other African countries and what have you. The Thai battalion is on en route. We're still shy, I should point out, we're still shy a couple of critical enabling capacities, which make it very difficult for us to move around and be as flexible as we need to be to operate in a place like Darfur.
And those presumably are helicopters. Hear a lot about the missing helicopters for Darfur.
Yeah, we're still shy aviation assets, both military and utility, and we're shy of hospital as well, which is important to keep our guys safe and to make sure that we can push out once we're there, because our people have the ability to respond from there, and then if something goes wrong, the ability to get treated quickly. So that those are small numbers we're talking about, but they're critical capabilities that we're missing.
How many helicopters are we talking about?
We're supposed to have a total of 24 helicopters. It's split between attack and utility, 18 plus 6.
Yeah.
And we have pledges for some of the attack helicopters, which we refer to as close support helicopters, tactical aviation. We do not have the pledges that we need for all of them, and we don't have the pledges for the utility helicopters. And this is something that's it's a big deal for us. We've been looking for these assets for years.
Yeah, it's been on the table for a long time. I mean, where are you looking? I mean, what countries have helicopters that you want but are not getting?
There's a lot of countries that have these types of assets, particularly with regard to the utility helicopters. That the combat aviation stuff, there are fewer countries that have it. But utility aviation, most countries have those capabilities, and those pledges simply haven't been forthcoming. We've gone out to the donor community several times, and we haven't gotten them. And we really do need to get these assets if the force is going to be as capable as it needs to be in order to complete the tasks it's been assigned by the Security Council.
Have you noticed any shift in how the United States is approaching the Darfur conflict upon President Obama assuming office in January?
I mean, from a UN perspective, we usually try to avoid commenting on the policies of individual member states. Having said that, we are working very closely closely with the current administration as well as we did with the previous administration to try to make sure that we get what we need to get the jobs we've been given. You know, the one thing I can certainly point to is that Americans have appointed a special envoy for Darfur, Scott Gration, and he's been very active in trying to bring together the major players in the region, hopefully he'll help and move the ball forward on the political track, because the way it works in peacekeeping is that we can accompany a political process, but we can't substitute for one. And if there isn't a viable and vibrant political process, eventually you're going to have a mission in trouble, because you can't succeed through the force of military arms alone if you're the UN.
So it was widely speculated that when the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court issued the so-called arrest warrant for Omar al-Bashir, that the UN's job would be much more complicated, and there were rumblings from folks at the UN that things were going to get a bit more difficult, a bit more challenging for them once this ICC action has been handed down. Has that it made news clearly, the expulsion of the number of aid agencies following the issue of the arrest warrants. How has that, if it has all, affected UN peacekeeping, the UN peacekeeping board?
Yeah, I mean, that would be the key thing to point to, is that the peacekeepers are being asked to do more on the humanitarian side because of the expulsion of the aid agencies. We continue to work closely with the Sudanese government. They are our host community. We continue to try to deal with them on operational issues, and that's our posture and our job. Our job is to put the maximum number of people on the ground that we can as quickly as possible in order to fulfill the tasks that we've been assigned. On the political side, that's something sort of for others. Our job is very specific. It's operational. It's in accordance with our mandate, and we're going to do everything we can to try to implement that mandate.
Now, maybe moving on to a different era. We'll move a little farther east to Somalia. There has been rumblings of a potential UN peacekeeping mission to Somalia, and I know that folks in this building, particularly in the Secretariat, are a bit hesitant or reluctant to want to go ahead full steam with such a deployment. And I'm wondering, what do you see as a potential of a Somalia peacekeeping force?
Well, the position of the Secretary General, I think, is very clear, that we are moving towards an eventual transition to a peacekeeping operation, provided that security conditions allow us to do so. In the meantime, we have a couple of things that are going on. First is that we are actively supporting AMISOM, which is the African Union mission that's there. We're actively supporting them by provision of materiel, by provision of technical support, by provision of equipment. Another thing that we're doing is we're building up our capability on the political side with UNPOS, which is the United Nations Political Office for Somalia, run by Secretary General Special Representative Uda Bolla.
Which is probably not in Somalia.
Which is right now based in Nairobi.
In Nairobi.
The security situation continues to be tremendously problematic.
Yeah.
And our view, which is the view of the Secretary General, is that in the conditions such as they are in Somalia, the time is not right for the deployment of a Blue Helmeted peace operation. So, until the situation changes, we will continue to move forward. We will continue to do everything we can to support AMISOM, continue to work on the political process through UNPOS, and try to help stabilize the situation however we can.
Now shifting a little further southwest to DRC, to Eastern Congo in particular. In October we saw an uptick in violence, mass outflows in the Goma region, tales of atrocities being committed by against civilians. I'm wondering, and at the time, the Security Council, if I recall correctly, authorized a surge of 3,000 troops to the affected region. Now we're like almost 8 months later. Have those troops arrived?
No, they haven't.
Why not?
The situation in eastern Congo is still problematic. It's still difficult. There are a number of armed elements that are still actively engaged there.
Yeah.
The Congolese army is addressing those issues with varying degrees of success. We act in support of the Congolese army, which is what our mandate says we are to do, but we also have a protection of civilians mandate, which is what we're trying to do. And we continue to have problems retaining and deploying the troops that we need to do the jobs that we're given. And this has certainly been the case in Congo. Now, we anticipate that these forces will arrive and they will arrive in the near future. But it has been months since the Secretary General, Special Representative Alan Doss, came to the Security Council and asked for those forces. We ask for these forces when we need them. We don't ask for them because it's something that we think would be a good safety zone. It's not. It's a requirement. And for us to accomplish the tasks we're given, we need to be given the resources by memberships. We don't have our own resources. There is no standing UN Army. There isn't sort of a pool of reserve officers that we can call on in order to deploy to these places. So we're dependent on the membership to provide the resources we need. And the membership has been supportive of the mission in Congo. There's a lot of people there, but we need more support if we're going to fulfill these tasks that we've been given.
And I guess maybe final question, again on Congo. It seems that this mission is unique from most other missions in the sense that the UN peacekeepers are sort of acting in concert with a party to the conflict, which is the Congolese government. Are you worried at all that this is maybe venture into morally ambiguous territory in the sense that these are not, this is not the Danish army we're talking about. These are armies without impeccable human rights records. Is this something that might be replicated in other missions?
I think there's a couple of points there. Yeah. First is that the Congolese army is the military force of the duly elected government of the DRC. That's just a statement of fact. Secondly, we have a mandate to support the Congolese government in its executing its authority over its sovereign territory. The instrument that it has at its control to do that through which it can do that is the Congolese Armed Forces, the FARDC. So we have no choice but to work with them. That's the deal. Now, having said that, part of what we have to do also is to do everything we can, since we have this supporting function, right, to try to hold the Congolese army accountable to the highest standards of behavior. Now, frankly, this has been an issue. There are elements, which are sometimes referred to as rogue elements within the Congolese army, that have committed atrocities, and we make representation to the Congolese government on those issues. But this is the Congolese military. This is a party to the conflict. It is the armed forces of the duly and democratically elected government of the DRC. So our perspective is you have to work with the government, you have to work with the military, and do everything you can to ensure, side by side, that they live up to the highest standards of behavior while executing the tasks that they need to do.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Nick. Logging Heads regular, Nick Birnbeck. Thank you.
Right, and now I'm joined with Aaron Kenny of the United Nations Population Fund. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, I guess tell us who you are and who you work for and what you do briefly, and then we'll get into the issues.
All right. I am the gender-based violence specialist at the UN Population Fund, UNFPA, in their humanitarian response branch. So essentially, I oversee the work of UNFPA in addressing gender-based violence, sexual violence, and other forms of gender-based violence in conflict, natural disaster, and in recovery settings.
Mm-hmm. I guess how does gender-based violence manifest itself in those situations?
Well, it varies from context to context. I mean, we see places like Rwanda or Bosnia or Darfur, other places in the world where we've actually seen gender-based violence, mostly rape and sexual violence, used as a tactic of warfare, used to displace populations or stabilize bonds or enable militia to kind of make their mark, literally. But we also see kind of more randomized sexual violence. So in a conflict or a natural disaster, everything gets destroyed. You have no social network, you have destruction of health services, destruction of police services, and there's opportunity for people to take advantage of power dynamics, of kind of the gender-based inequalities that might exist prior to a conflict, and engage in sexual violence, other forms of intimate partner violence, domestic violence, with relative impunity.
And it seems one issue that's gaining traction, at least here in the United States, at least is starting to bubble to the surface, is the issue of sexual violence in Eastern DRC, in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
I mean, it's been going on for centuries, but the international community is definitely much more aware of the issues there. There's a tremendously strong civil society in Congo who's been raising the battle cry for a long time, and I think we all are taking notice. UNFPA has actually been working to address issues of sexual violence in the Congo for decades, and felt for many years that we were kind of working alone, and I think it's very heartening in many ways to see how many people are getting engaged, but also sad because I think that we've probably had an opportunity to mitigate what's happening now had we joined forces a decade ago and done more.
So speaking about joining forces a decade ago, one of the things preventing us from joining forces were the political climate here in the United States, I think it's fair to say. Within days of assuming the presidency, the President Obama reversed the so-called global gag rule, and also reverse restrictions on American funding to your organization.
Yeah.
So this was a big deal.
Moment of celebration for us, for sure.
So, I mean, how did you expect that, first of all, and how has your experience or your work changed since that happened, or has it changed?
I think we did expect that, and I think we were all that. I mean, his choice, his own record, and then his choice of the vice president, getting Hillary Clinton onto his staff. You know, he's got advocates for all of our issues around him. I don't think any of us were surprised by this direction. I think we were all incredibly pleased. Speaking as one of the few Americans who works at UNFPA, I felt that I could carry my head a little bit higher walking in the hallways of UNFPA. We will get a level of funding now from the U.S. government. They have a commitment to issues that I care deeply about. They're very committed to violence against women issues in conflict and beyond. I think it's incredibly hopeful.
Now, are there any kind of issue areas or geographical hotspots that don't really, that don't make the news very often, that we might be surprised that there's something terrible happening?
Well,
in terms of violence against women.
Yeah, I mean, there are probably many, but a couple come to mind. One is Central African Republic. So most people have never even heard of Central African Republic, much less know about the levels of sexual violence that are going on there. But if you think about where it's situated, it's bordering on Darfur, on Congo, on Chad, all these other countries that we have heard, at least with Darfur and Congo, have heard something about. But it's completely neglected. It's neglected by donors, it's neglected in the media, it's neglected by many actors who could do something about it.
And interestingly, it seems one actor that didn't ignore it was the International Criminal Court, right? If I'm correct, it was, this is the first time that the ICC prosecutor is going after crimes against women as a crimes against humanity under the ICC statute. So that must be invigorating to a certain extent.
Entirely invigorating. Yeah. In fact, it's happening more and more where the ICC is recognizing rape as a crime against humanity and is taking action to prosecute criminals according to that statute. The one challenge, and we're seeing this in Darfur, is that it does have unintended consequences on services for survivors. I mean, in Darfur, as you know, recently 14 NGOs have been kicked asked to leave the country, and most of them did have some kind of protection mandate. Many of them were providing services for women under an umbrella of women's health or women's wellness. We weren't necessarily calling them sexual violence programs, but there's a real gap now. There's a real impact on women because of this. And that was directly linked to the ICC indictment.
And I'm also, so aside from CAR, any other areas of similar, somewhat obscurity that we might...
There are places that are not necessarily entirely off the radar screen, but I think that we get a little bit complacent about it. We just kind of forget about them because we hear so much about Darfur and Eastern Congo, places like Haiti, and Myanmar, and Zimbabwe, where access to populations is restricted, particularly in places like Myanmar and Zimbabwe, which to me means that the people that we most need to reach are probably suffering even more than we know. I just returned from Zimbabwe, and it's interesting because I think that we need to wake up to what's happening there, and pretty fast. I mean, I think we all know about the economic crisis, we know about what's happening there, but there's an opportunity for the power sharing agreement between Mugabe and Morgan Tsvangirai, and people, Zimbabweans, despite everything, feel hopeful. And I think if we can go in there and support them more, we talked to women and men and boys and girls in communities. They talked about what's happening. They feel that sexual violence is worse now than it was in 2008. And I have to say, the level of sexual exploitation, the number of young girls who are, you know, are being forced to kind of trade sex just to support their families is only going to increase. And, you know, the funding levels, I think we recently got about $100,000 from a global appeal for money to address this issue, and that was going to be a drop in the bucket.
For Zimbabwe, specific.
Yeah.
I guess it sounds like you have a really fascinating job. How did you get to where you are? This sounds interesting.
Well, I started actually where you are. I started as a journalist. I studied journalism as an undergrad, moved to the Balkans in 96, and really wanted to pursue a career in media and writing. Yeah. And when I got there, I was really acutely affected by the issues, particularly issues affecting women, and wanted to take action in a much more proactive way, and then just built my career around doing that.
Well, thank you so much.
This is
wonderful. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you. I am now joined by Andrew Hudson of the United Nations Development Program. Andrew, will you explain sort of what it is you do in your title?
Sure. My title, I'm the cluster leader of the UNDP Water Governance Program. And in essence, we work on water issues in a range of settings, both marine and freshwater. Everything from local level work, including helping communities get access to water supply, to sanitation services, up through to national water policies, programs that we work on, and then up to even the regional. We do a lot of work on transboundary waters, both freshwater and marine, shared river basins, shared marine ecosystems that multiple countries have to learn to better manage together as shared waters.
So where right now around the world today are some of the more critical water areas that you deal with?
Well, say on the freshwater side, you have still a wide number of countries that are not on track to meet the so-called Millennium Development Goals of the United Nations, the MDGs. These are to halve the proportion of people that have access to water and sanitation services by the year 2015 from a 1994 or so baseline. And so while there has been a lot of progress made, particularly the water target, there are still dozens and dozens of countries in all regions of the world that still have a lot of progress to go to make this access target for water and sanitation.
Have a sit, no problem. We're informal here. So two areas that kind of pop up in the news in terms of what I think exemplifies sort of the water scarcity issues, and it seems to be the Aral Sea and Lake Chad. I'm wondering if that falls within your remit, or how to help the border countries of both the Aral Sea and Lake Chad deal with these.
Right. We actually are. We're working in Lake Chad, exactly in that area, helping the four, five net countries that share the Lake Chad Basin improve their joint management. Aral Sea, UNDP has worked in the past. We're not at present, but that's a classic sort of case study example of a really catastrophic mismanagement of water resources.
So I guess, climate change is obviously part of it. What sort of human factors have contributed to the depletion of, say, the Aral Sea?
Well, in fact, this process goes way back to the 40s and 50s, really the policies of the then Soviet Union on highly inefficient and overuse of the scarce water feeding into the Aral Sea, mainly the two rivers, the Sir Daria and the Aro Daria. So if anything, I would not connect most, if not any, of that catastrophe to climate change.
Okay.
It was primarily driven by weak policies, and these are widely acknowledged now and understood. And the real challenge is, how do you reverse, in many ways, decades-old mismanagement, inappropriate water use policies, and restore something at the scale of the Aral Sea?
Yeah.
We're seeing there is a local success in the Aral Sea, one of the northern sort of sub-basins of what really became a multiple water body system because of the desiccation and withdrawal of the system, has been recovered with support from the World Bank and others. So there is a small-scale success in the Aral Sea, but the larger success would still require quite dramatic changes in the water use in that region.
And Lake Chad?
Lake Chad has faced similar, not quite as extreme, but still quite important issues with evaporation and water loss leading to its reduction in size. But I think there's a lot more hope there, that through work that we're supporting, also the World Bank and other United Nations agencies, we are supporting those two countries to jointly improve their water resources management, improve water use efficiency, improve the management of the key ecosystems that in turn help protect and maintain the quality and quantity of those water bodies, of that water body.
And so maybe beyond Lake Chad, beyond the Aral Sea, are there any other areas that we should be paying more attention to?
Certainly, another area that a lot of attention has been paid to, but it's still much to do, is in the Nile Basin. UNDP has been working there for over 15 years, supporting the 10 countries that share the Nile Basin in creating new institutions. The so-called Nile Basin Initiative and Nile Basin Authority are being created. We've supported, for example, the negotiation process now for over 10 years in creating a cooperative framework, really a legal framework for the Nile Basin, which we hope will go forward in the coming years to create a formal institutional and legal and policy framework for these countries to improve management of that critical resource for the roughly 70 plus million people who live in the Nile Basin.
Well, thank you. And any other parting thoughts? Any other thing viewers should be?
Well, I can highlight tomorrow, June 5th, is World Environment Day.
Yes.
So we're celebrating that, of course, and it's quite important. And by good coincidence, Monday, June 8th, is World Oceans Day, which was designated as such by the United Nations General Assembly last year. So this will be the first official celebration by the United Nations and the global community of World Oceans Day.
And I should put in a plug for my own website. We'll be talking a lot about Law of the Sea on World Oceans Day, June 8th. So tune in. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.